So really pleased to talk about work and Buddhism and how it possibly, hopefully, can all fit together. So my talk's called Work, Inner Work and Looking for Meaning. And I wanted to start with a quote which was on the, Ratna Prabhu put it on the kind of email about tonight, a bit of a quote from Steve Jobs, who I'm sure a few nods around the room know who he is, Mr. Apple. So the full quote is, "Your work is going to fill a large part of your life, and the only way to be truly satisfied is to do what you believe is great work. And the only way to do great work is to love what you do. And if you haven't found it yet, keep looking. Don't settle. As in all matters of the heart, you know when you find it." So although he's not a Buddhist, he actually apparently was very interested in Buddhism, apparently toyed with being a Buddhist monk. But he obviously founded one of the most kind of successful companies probably of recent times, a great entrepreneur, businessman, and yet obviously had some interest in spiritual aspiration as well. And I certainly find those words very inspiring in my current context. So I just wanted to say a little bit about why and link that to Buddhism, because I think what he's saying has so much to say in terms of our aspiration and Buddhist life, really. So when he uses, when he links the sense of satisfaction with belief in what you do, that to me had a lot of links to faith and having a sense of knowing something's right and keeping on until you find that. So he talks about keeping on looking, and that felt to me like a sense of quest and exploration, which I really associate with a spiritual life, trying to figure it out and keep going. It's a journey. It's not a formulaic solution. We have to figure it out. He talks about loving what you do, and certainly in Buddhism, there's a lot about joy, isn't there? And about how to bring joy and positivity into our life and into our experience. And in fact, one of our core practices, the metta practice, very much links to that, doesn't it? That's what we're trying to develop, positive emotion. And he talks about don't settle until you find it. So that to me linked very much to a sense of energy, or virya is a word you sometimes hear. So don't be complacent. Don't just be cozy. Don't just give up. You know, keep on, keeping on really. So those elements I think are very important in terms of being successful in our lives, whether we associate that with work, whether it's paid or not, or whether we associate it with our spiritual life, because hopefully there isn't a great distinction between the two. So I want to talk a little bit about that as well. But just before I get going, I just wanted to say for the purposes of tonight, what I mean by work is daytime activity, or it could be nighttime activity, but basically activity doesn't have to be paid, doesn't have to be what we'd say is a job, where we go to a place every day and get a salary. So I just want us to think quite broadly. So it could be volunteering, it could be being a parent, it could be looking after other people. But our experience might have an element of routineness to it, and it might have a sense of regularity to it. It's likely to involve other people, whether in person or virtually. So a lot of activity these days is not necessarily physically in the same room, is it, as somebody else. Has elements of communication, and finally has an element of transaction to it. So we do something and we experience something back in return. So it could be money, but it may not be. It could be something else, and that feels quite important. So let's think about work very broadly. That's what I was thinking about in terms of tonight. And the reason why work, in that broadest sense, is so brilliant in terms of a Buddhist practice is because it has elements of it that repeat themselves over and over again. They, in a working context, in any of those environments, we have a fantastic opportunity to recognise our own tendencies. So things like what we feel about expertise, being good at something, what we feel about ownership, is it mine, will I share it? What do we feel about status? Do we need money to feel that we have some status? Is it important to have recognition from other people around us? So those things come up regularly in terms of our daytime or nighttime activities. There's also an interface between ourselves and, of course, the world. So that could be just one other person that we're with a lot, or it could be a team of people, or it could be much, much broader than that. We could be part of a much bigger organisation or community. But there is an interface there between ourselves and the rest of the world. There's also a sense, I think, that something that comes up for me is, or something that I've explored a lot in these contexts, is do people like me? So how I am in these contexts, is it important that people like what I do and how I behave or not? Because when we're often in these kind of roles, people can assume certain things about us in connection with our organisation or our status, or if we're a manager or if we're not a manager. Are we a team player, or are we somebody who prefers solo work? So those kind of things can often bring up a sense of, do people like what I do and does it matter? And also, what does it mean to do a good job? So does it have to be excellent? Does it have to be good? Or is good enough okay? So there's a kind of standard that I think we apply to our activity. And the Buddha says a lot about that, about how we behave externally and how that impacts on us internally. And then, as I've mentioned, there's around the notion of transaction, but there's also linked to that the idea of remuneration. So what do we get back from the other party or the organisation or as a result of the activity, and how important is that? So as Bodhilila said, I have different jobs and I have different responses in those contexts. So I have been at Croydon on the centre team, not getting any financial payment for that. I still am a volunteer on the reception there. I've had paid employment. I've got a job at the moment. I've had it for years, actually, in the civil service, the Ministry of Justice. So I get paid for that, and I get a pension that's part of that. So that feels a very kind of traditional kind of work. I run my own business, so I train people in mindfulness, and I do business training as well. And I'm also a volunteer in a prison, teaching other prisoners how to teach people to read on their wing. And very recently, my mum has moved from Yorkshire to about 20 minutes from where I live, and that really does feel like having a new job. It is quite a challenge. So I feel that I'm working in all of those ways, with a capital W, in all of those contexts. So let's just have a little bit of a dig around in what the Buddha said about work in all of those different contexts. Well, for a start, he didn't actually have a paid job. So I think that's quite important to remember. He had a fantastic life initially, very privileged life. No need to worry about what he was going to do for a living, because he was a prince. So absolutely loaded, and had people running around after him doing whatever he wanted. However, as you probably know, obviously, his life didn't actually end up like that. And he ended up, as we know, after a quest, meditating, teaching, learning, sharing, taking care of people, taking care of his own community of monks and nuns and followers. And he certainly wasn't in it for the money. So although he did receive alms, support, money, food, his lifestyle, in terms of how to use that word, we would say it was very, very simple, the absolute bare basics. But he certainly wasn't in it for fees or a salary. That wasn't his driver. But he was aware of the need for work in a traditional sense, and had quite a lot to say about that, to say about how best to work in the world. So where it kind of fits is part of the Noble Eightfold Path, which is the way that the Buddha taught as a way to lead from suffering. And eight different aspects he looked at, covering the whole of our lives. But one of those aspects was about livelihood. And he did have a lot to say about that whole notion of what we do with our working life. And our own teacher and founder, Sangharakshita, also has said a lot about this whole area as well. I just looked back at a very early text of his, Vision and Transformation, which is really good actually on the Noble Eightfold Path, but particularly on the aspect of livelihood. It's quite interesting reading it through, you know, a modern lens, if you like. It feels quite old-fashioned reading it in a way, but he has got some really fantastic stuff to say about work. So let's just have a look at those two kind of perspectives, really. So in terms of actually what Sangharakshita said, he contrasts the ideal life, a place called Sukhavati, a sort of idealised mythical place, really, where there certainly wouldn't be a sense of that kind of Monday morning feeling, or the sense of having a horrible boss, or the sense of it being really uphill. Life would be a blissful place, really. And what Sangharakshita does is talk about that, in how to achieve that in our everyday life, where we're certainly not, in an everyday sense, most of the time, in a state we would probably describe as Sukhavati. It certainly doesn't feel like that living in London a lot of the time. So, but what he talks about is the recognition that what we do with our livelihood has such a huge impact on the collective existence, on that interface between the rest of the world. So the time, the amount of time that we spend on that is clearly going to affect our mind, and is clearly going to affect other people around us. So it's unavoidable, really, to explore what we do with our daytime activity, really. And he goes as far as to say that unless one conforms to the ideal, that we interface with the world, and that we have an impact collectively on the world, unless we conform to that, that there's very little progress is possible. So that's quite a strong statement, isn't it? So then, if you go back to what the Buddha said about, well, what do you do with that whole notion of earning a living and occupation and what you do with your time? He had some very clear guidelines, well, a bit stronger than that, really, about things that were unhelpful, unethical pursuits. And those are things that I don't think we would disagree with these days. So he listed them very, very culturally appropriate, really. Things like trafficking, slaughter of animals, selling poison. Don't think many of us get involved in that, although selling drink was on his list of things not to do. selling weapons, astrology, palmistry, and acting with an intention of increasing greed, hatred and delusion in other people. So kind of very clear, it's kind of quite easy to spot, isn't it, what we do with our lives against that kind of template. So what Sangharakshita does is make that a bit more contemporary, and he, I think very helpfully, looks at it through three different contexts. So the idea of occupation, the idea of vocation, and the idea of duration. So as with all things Sangharakshita-wise, well-written-wise, you get lists like you do with the Buddha. So let's just have a bit of a look at those three things. So he defines there are some jobs that are never right in any circumstances. I imagine those would be the things like, you know, the poison, selling the poison, and, you know, getting involved in things that increase greed, hatred and delusion of other people, in other people. Things that aren't necessarily wrong but do increase the greed of others. So he lists things like the advertising industry. So quite interesting just to explore that a bit. And maybe, you know, if he was writing it now, I don't know, that I would imagine there may be something in there about the whole notion of consumerism, the internet, our relationship with wanting and aspiring more materially. And are we involved in work that does that? He also talks about a category of activity that could be basically okay if you made a bit of an effort with it. So that's things like if you put effort into being kind, effort into being honest. So you were raising the bar a little bit, that your activity would therefore be great, you know, would be fine. So that's a kind of a big catch-all, really, for a lot of our mundane activities. He's basically just saying put a bit of effort in, and you know, it will have a result. And then he also talks about work or occupation that involves mental strain that would affect your meditation. So again, that's quite interesting, isn't it? That is a very direct comparison between if you just bring to mind what you do during the day and how does that affect your ability to meditate? What state are you in when you then try and meditate as a result of what you've been doing during the day? So switching a little bit to the notion of vocation. So what he means in this context is what's most important and ultimate, and that there should be ideally no difference between work and non-work. So a sense of a kind of continuity across all activity. And certainly, I mean, I still feel it now, but I certainly felt it when I first got involved with Buddhism and the Sangha, that disconnect between being it was down the road, but a Buddhist context and a working context. And there was a real disconnect. And I used to feel that literally walking through the door of the centre, how different that felt to walking through the door of where I was working. So that really helped me raise the bar a bit, so that I consciously, when I stepped through the door at work, consciously tried to be more careful around my speech, for example, tried to be kept more careful around my humour, which, being from Yorkshire, was quite strong and very much part of my identity. But I realised in a working context could sometimes offend people. Whereas in the centre, I was much more cautious about what I said and how much I contributed and how I used my humour. So it did feel like there was a disconnect between those two environments. So it was, so to bring that together was a very conscious and quite sometimes quite a struggle, really, so that I wouldn't feel split and that I was in two different environments, really. So just worth having to think about that. How do we feel when we're in this kind of context, and how do we feel when we're not, and what is it that makes it different, if it is different? Maybe it isn't. Something that I think Sangharakshita is quite famous for saying is, in terms of duration, around work, how much time should I devote to earning a living? And he has said, as little as possible. Which is great, I think, as little as possible. So just enough to live on, you know, just enough to live on. So, you know, clearly the Buddha very much was in that territory. So that, basically what he's saying, is you can devote the rest of your life to Dharma activities. So you need enough to, you know, obviously not get yourself into debt, not be sponging off people, but you don't need masses and masses and masses. So that's a brilliant question, I think. What is enough to live on? Really good question. You know, we could talk all night about money and attitudes to money and what do we really think we need. But it's a brilliant question, I think, to pose about what is just enough, really. And he also talks about the fact that we need people with one foot in the world and one foot in the spiritual world, and to act as a bridge, is his phrase. And I like that idea of acting as a bridge. It fits very much in terms of my connection to Tara. She has one foot stepping down into the world and one leg in a meditation posture. So very much active and also still and meditative. So the bridge feels a good analogy for me, rather than a stepping through the door, which is what I experienced in my early days of getting involved. So to feel at ease in, to feel at ease in both areas, really. Right, so so I just wanted to say a bit about going back to what Steve Jobs said, and also linking clearly with the Buddha and Sangharakshita, is about vision. So to keep doing something day after day in a routine sense, in a sense of being connected with other people and trying to practice, needs effort. And effort we don't want to be dry, ideally. We want it to have some sparkle. We want it to feel like it's worthwhile, like there's a point, really. So vision can be the thing that kind of lifts it when it does feel dry. So looking and keeping on looking can be, I think, quite a useful way if you are feeling uninspired. Is this the right activity for me? Is this the right job? Am I doing the best thing with my time? It doesn't have to be paid stuff. And again, I've experienced that a lot. I did keep looking and looking till I found a really satisfying activity. And that is the activity involved in the prison work, actually, which has definitely no financial reward attached to it at all. But it feels a very inspiring place to be, to have a connection to people that are clearly struggling, and also a place that brings me up against my own fears and limitations. So one thing I don't feel comfortable in is being in a place where I'm locked in at all. I have quite a phobia of those kind of situations. I think phobia is quite strong now, but I feel very uneasy being in institutions with locked doors. So to be in those kind of places, hospitals or prisons, it isn't an easy place for me to be, and yet it's a very inspiring environment, and it's somewhere where I've really experienced my practice ramped up several notches, really. So when I read that quote from Steve Jobs about just keeping on till you find it, and that your heart knows when you find it, that really resonates with me in terms of that activity, but also in terms of keeping on with practice. Just keeping on. So even though some days you don't feel like maybe meditating, just do it. Sometimes just sitting on the bus with your eyes closed and connecting to the environment, it isn't meditation on a cushion, but it's awareness. And it's mindfulness in the environment that you're in. So that is practice. That is keeping on. just noticing the details. So sometimes I'm quite bored when I'm in my civil service job. And yet I'm in a fantastic tower block, 13 floors up, with probably one of the most spectacular views in London. It overlooks the Houses of Parliament and the London Eye. And when the sun is at a certain point, in fact, it happened today, it's like there's a golden beam that goes, just catches the top of the clock on Big Ben. And it is quite extraordinary to see that beam of light happen. It's quite magical. And it, of course, it doesn't happen, you know, you can't predict when it's going to happen. But it happens at certain times of the day, obviously, and if the light is absolutely right and if the sun is there at that point. So that, again, is an example for me of lifting my mental states, to making an effort in those situations that Sangharakshita talked about. So putting a bit of effort in lifts the bar a bit, seeing that beautiful light in an environment that sometimes I feel quite stale in really does lift me and just give me a bit of sparkle, really. And I think that sometimes the details are sometimes all we have in our working everyday environment. If the whole picture feels too hard or too difficult, then looking for the details can really bring a vision back to us that perhaps we've lost. So sometimes choosing something like a door that you walk through all the time, or a queue that you stood in a lot, or a lift that you're in regularly, or a bus journey that you're on. So choosing something that you do regularly, and consciously choosing that, and then you go towards that activity with a sense of curiosity. So what will it be like this time when I pull the door open? What will it be like this time when I sit on the bus? So bringing a sense of newness to a frequently done experience, which is what often happens in work, doesn't it, in our regular daytime activity. So looking for the details, I think, is quite can be quite important when the overall picture can seem overwhelming or dull. And because of our practice, what we do is we have those two key practices, don't we? We have mindfulness that accentuates the details. We use the breath to anchor us and also to notice the breath coming and going. We may use counting as part of that practice. But essentially, we're looking in quite a lot of detail at something. The focus is our breath, so we can make the focus quite narrow, take our attention in, and improve our ability to notice the tiny, tiny things of our experience. And yet we also have, on the other hand, our metta practice, which is the expansive one, isn't it, that brings heart to our responses. So in all of those, examples of our everyday life, what we're also trying to do is bring in our heart connection to those. And in those situations, sometimes I've felt like I've really failed, or I've let myself down, or I've been harsh to other people. I haven't been the best I can be. So bringing in the kindness to that, noticing is the first thing, and then bringing kindness to it, not bringing another sense of I've failed to it. Because we don't need that. We know when we've not been the best we can be. So what often is helpful is bringing kindness to it and then just letting us see what happens in that situation. So this evening, I just before I came here, I was sat having a cup of tea over the road with a friend of mine. And I had this object in my bag, which was my work laptop. It's a civil service laptop. And there's a lot of, occasionally you hear in the newspaper about people foolishly leaving their laptops on trains with all these, you know, highly confidential data on it. And of course, when that happens, there's a lot of humour at the office about that. How could anybody do it? That's so stupid. How could they possibly, you know, what a ridiculous thing. Da, 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 da. And of course, what did I do tonight? I've had my laptop stolen. So I'm now immediately thrown into that kind of vortex of what am I going to look like in my working life tomorrow? You know, people are going to know that I've done this really foolish thing somehow. This laptop has escaped from my person. I'll have to explain how it happened, which I don't really know. So that will also, I'm already thinking, what shall I say? Shall I be honest? Shall I come up with some fantastic story? So all sorts of things have gone through my mind. Coming back to those things that I mentioned a few minutes ago about, you know, reputation, about will people like me? Will it be funny? Will I get told off? So loads of stuff is coming, you know, into it came just hit me in a matter of seconds. And yet, what happened was I anticipated all of those things. I had to contact my boss to tell her. And she sent me a really short email saying, don't worry, there's a form to fill in, but don't worry about it tonight. I was thinking, oh, right, is that it? You know. So, but really what she was doing was being kind, wasn't she? She was being kind. She knows I feel rubbish about it and foolish. So, yeah, she's just acted in an extremely kind way. So that, for me, felt a really good example of, bringing kindness to bear. In a situation that, you know, in that moment was highly, highly stressful. Just want to finish with a little bit about not doing activity, work, volunteering, caring, withdrawing, because that is also an activity, and it's an activity that in spiritual life we are really encouraged to look at and explore. So to go on retreats where we're on our own rather than with a group of people, they're called solitary retreats. And really interesting thing to do if you are up for it. But you may feel perhaps, oh, I don't necessarily want to go and spend a weekend on my own or a week with myself. But perhaps maybe just try a day of it. Just try a day of being solitary. You can do it reasonably easily at home. The hardest thing might be just to turn off electrical devices and don't look at them. You know, that can be quite an interesting experience. And just notice what happens if we don't have the regular stimulation that we have during our everyday life. And notice what happens if you feel the pull to look at your phone or email or just... see what's going on outside your environment. So just staying with ourselves in a solitary context can teach us an enormous amount about how we then might be when we cross that bridge back to have connection with other people. And of course, in our practice on our cushion, we are in connection with other people too, aren't we? So if you just had just an invitation really to try a day of being solitary, try a bit of meditation, try a bit of activity, notice those details, you know, this door when I open it, what does it feel like when I'm really paying attention, this cup of tea, you know, that I normally just gulp down and rush out the door, what's it like to take it slow and just try it. So just, you know, I don't know, just as an invitation really to try a day of putting it all down and trying to, and just see what happens really, see what happens with it. So I'm going to stop talking now, but I do want to end back with Mr. Apple actually. Because the reason why this is important to explore how best we can use our time during the day is because, as he says so well, remember you will be dead soon. And remembering you will be dead soon is the most important tool I've ever encountered to help me make choices in life. Your time is limited, so don't waste it by living someone else's life. Don't be trapped by dogma, which is living the results of somebody else's thinking. Don't let the noise of other people's opinions drown you out. Most important, have the courage to follow your heart and your intuition. They, that's your heart and intuition, know what you truly want to become, and everything else is secondary.